This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden and Japan's Fumio Kishida met for talks in the symbolic city of Hiroshima on Thursday, aiming for closer cooperation in the face of an ascendant China and an unpredictable Russia, Reuters' Jillian Kitchener reports.
Here, in the first city ever hit with an atomic weapon, G7 members, which include host Japan, along with the U.S., Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, and Canada, are increasingly concerned by what they see as Russia's repeated threats over the use of nuclear arms. They're also alarmed by an ascendant China, with economically coercive policies and its rapid accumulation of sensitive technology. Biden and Japan's Fumio Kishida met for talks Thursday, aiming for closer cooperation in the face of these challenges. Japan, although a longtime buyer of Russian oil, has moved in tandem with G7 sanctions against Moscow following Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Jillian Kitchener reporting. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky set up a reintegration council on Thursday to advise on the restoration of Ukrainian rule over Crimea. VOA's Diane Roberts has the story.
Zelensky said he signed the decree about the Advisory Council on Reintegration and Deoccupation of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol. His comments came during a gathering to mark the day of the Soviet-era Crimean Tatars' mass deportation. Russia shows no sign of abandoning Crimea, which it seized and annexed in 2014. Russia has used the peninsula as a platform to launch missile strikes on Ukrainian targets. Ukrainian officials have repeatedly said that seizing the peninsula back from Russia was one of its key war aims. Diane Roberts, VOA News.
And for more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. An Australian doctor held captive by Al-Qaeda-linked extremists for more than 7 years in West Africa has been released and is back with his family, according to the Australian government. Dr. Kenneth Elliott and his wife were abducted in January of 2016 near the Burkina Faso border with Mali, where they had operated a 120-bed clinic for more than 40 years. Jocelyn Elliott was freed after 3 weeks. Pakistani police have continued a siege on the home of former Premier Imran Khan, even after a 24-hour deadline expired. We get more on the story from AP correspondent Karen Chalmers.
The deadline was given by authorities for Khan to hand over suspects allegedly sheltered inside his house. The demand for suspects wanted in violent protests over Khan's recent detention has angered many of Khan's supporters. Along with the ongoing siege, tensions are high and fears are raised over possible renewed clashes between them and security forces. A week earlier, Khan's supporters attacked public property and military installations after he was dragged out of a courtroom and arrested in a graft case. I'm Karen Chamas.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani now reporting on a Supreme Court decision on the liability of social media.
The High Court avoided the big issue hovering over the cases by not ruling on the federal law shielding internet companies from being sued for what users post. But the justices did unanimously reject a suit alleging Google, Twitter, and Facebook allowed their platforms to be used in aiding and abetting a Turkish nightclub attack that killed 39 people 6 years ago. The High Court returned the case of an American college student killed in a Paris terror attack to a lower court. Families of victims in both attacks said the companies did not do enough to keep extremist groups from using the platforms to radicalize and recruit people. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Assailants killed three rangers and another member of their convoy in an ambush in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo on Thursday, according to the Congo Institute of Nature Conservation. The attackers struck near the Virunga National Park, which is home to half the global population of the endangered mountain gorillas and the scene of frequent militia attacks. The ICCN said six other people were wounded. Rescue crews are working to reach towns and villages in northern Italy that were cut off from highways, electricity, and cell phone service following heavy rains and flooding there. The death toll from the rains that pushed two dozen rivers and tributaries to burst their banks stood at 9, with some people still unaccounted for. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 19. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Rights groups say Sudan's warring sides show a reckless disregard for civilians in Western Darfur.
I mean, residents I talked with in the last weeks, they were very explicit about the risk they're facing. I mean, people who are stranded that they can't leave because they're afraid of their life. They can't have access to healthcare or services.
Malawi uses force to relocate refugees. UNICEF raises the alarm about rising gender-based violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Zambia launches a DNA lab to investigate sexual offenses. African countries work to reduce road accident deaths as the world marks Road Safety Week this week.
He died in a car crash. The driver was like a drunkard and he was chewing and too much music. And my brother was like telling him there's a sharp road and you should be careful. And that's when the incidents occurred.
And the National Union of Tunisian Journalists protest the arrest and conviction of media workers. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rights groups say Sudan's warring sides are showing a reckless disregard for civilians in Western Darfur, the other epicenter of Sudan's civil war. Henry Wilkins speaks to refugees in Borota, Chad, who have managed to escape the region, but say armed groups are targeting, harassing, and sometimes preventing others from leaving.
Ali Abed Allah Yacoub, a Sudanese refugee, says his 32-year-old son is stuck in Jenina, the capital of West Darfur province at the heart of Sudan's civil war. This video, posted by a Sudanese journalist on social media, purports to show the fighting. Reports, which are difficult to verify due to a lack of access to the city, say hundreds may have been killed in fighting there over the weekend. Yacoub says he fears for his son's life.
If they try to run away, they might beat him up or even kill him. That's why he cannot come. Even some of the refugees who managed to escape here have been beaten up.
Many Sudanese refugees VOA spoke to in Chad said they were left with a near impossible choice: stay in Jenina and get caught in the crossfire, or brave the road to Chad, where armed groups may attack or kill them. This refugee, who declined to give her name out of fear for her family's safety, says she left family members in Jenina for that reason.
Some of my family members remain here, but it is not safe. They report to me what happened. They told me that people are desperate because of the killings. They killed three of my brothers.
The non-profit Human Rights Watch says both sides in Sudan's war are showing a reckless disregard for civilian lives by using explosives and destroying hospitals. They also say that despite this, people are afraid to leave.
I mean, residents I talked with in the last weeks, they were very explicit about the risk they're facing. I mean, not only the impact of the fighting, you know, the displacement, the destructions of gathering sites, but also checkpoints, extortion and looting on the way. So people who are stranded that they can't leave because they're afraid of their life, they can't have access to healthcare or services.
Yacoub says he lost contact with his son last week after the cell phone network in Jenina was cut.
The last time we talked, they told me that he couldn't escape and was locked in. It is too dangerous to leave the front door. And even if he could, he would still be in danger.
An agreement between the warring Sudanese army and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces was reached last week to allow safe passage for refugees leaving Sudan. Fighting has continued, however, and there are still few opportunities to get out of the country safely. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kafrun and Barota, Chad.
Malawi has started to forcefully evict and relocate refugees who live and do business outside the country's only refugee camp, Zaleka, in the central part of the country. The exercise, which started Wednesday, follows the expiration of the April 15 deadline set by Malawi in February for about 8,000 refugees to voluntarily relocate to their designated camp. Police say about 400 families were evicted from their homes and business premises in some areas of the capital, Lilongwe. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The government says those staying outside the camp are a threat to national security and also violate policies which prohibit refugees from staying or doing business outside the camp. Patrick Botha is the spokesperson for the Minister of Homeland Security in Malawi. He told VOA Thursday that the police and immigration officers have so far flushed out 480 refugees, including 100 children who are kept temporarily at a prison facility in the capital, Lilongwe.
This morning, we're undertaking the screening process to isolate those that have refugee status so that they can go back to the camp, and then those that have valid business permits so that they can go back to their normal life.
Botha says the exercise comes after noting that many foreigners who had their refugee status rejected flock to the cities and towns where they do business illegally.
So it is these people we're trying to flush out, because in the first place they are not supposed to be in this country. And the fact that instead of going back, they decided to infiltrate the location, the localities, in towns, cities, and other areas, poses a threat to national security.
The crackdown came about 2 months after the expiration of the April 15 deadline the Malawi government set for about 8,000 refugees to voluntarily relocate to their designated camp. Dzaleka is home to refugees and asylum seekers from Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Somalia. The camp was meant to accommodate about 10,000 refugees, but now is home to more than 50,000. However, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and rights campaigners have long argued that relocating them to the highly congested camp violates rights of those affected. Refugees who have so far returned to Dzaleka have told VOA that they are sleeping in the open with no food and clothes. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has called for an urgent scale-up of interventions and funding to respond to rising sexual violence against children and women in the DRC's North Kivu province. Grant Liete is the UNICEF representative in the country. He tells me that gender-based violence in North Kivu increased by 37% in the first 3 months of 2023. He says women and children in refugee camps are the most vulnerable.
Well, I think, James, you know, the situation has been unstable but relatively constant in the east of DRC since around about 2013 up until 2021. But we've really seen a substantial decline in the situation since March of last year. There's over 1.1 million new IDPs, and that's in the space of just over 12 months. And that's being driven by a conflict which is really escalated in three different parts of the East. And we are seeing people really in a very, very vulnerable situation. So we are very worried about these trends. And we don't think it's yet come to an end. Things, if they continue in this way, are going to get worse.
So you talk about the number of people in the eastern part of the country, the DRC. I mean, there are many groups that are involved in the crisis there. There's M23 and other rebel groups. The DRC army is also operating there. Who are the people responsible for this alarming rate of rape that you are talking about?
This is a difficult thing to pin down, given that by definition, this is always going to happen in a kind of a clandestine way. So there isn't actually any concrete evidence on exactly who is responsible.
So, and you are calling for urgent and significant scale up of intervention and funding. What activities are UNICEF involved in to help prevent this situation?
There are over 9 major sites just to the north of Goma. We have set up these safe spaces in 4 of those IDP sites, where we are doing a lot of sensitization. So we are putting out information around these risks so that women and girls are aware and they are looking out and taking care about how they go and collect firewood, for example, or not to fall into these traps. So there's the prevention side. We are also talking to authorities. We've expressed our concern. And I think this is not simply an issue which can be resolved by humanitarians alone. On the prevention side, there needs to be a security dimension to that.
Grant Laity is the UNICEF DRC representative. He was speaking with me from the city of Kananga in central Kasai province. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, May 19. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. In an effort to address the increasing number of cases of gender and sexual violence, Zambia has launched the first ever DNA forensic laboratory in the country at a cost of more than $600,000. The facility, which is being supported by the United States and Ireland, will enhance investigations of sexual and gender violence. Kathy Schwartz reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
Zambia reports more than 20,000 gender and sexual violence cases, most of which concern girls, babies, and women. But a lack of scientific evidence allows most perpetrators to go free. Zambia's Home Affairs and Internal Security Minister Jack Mwembo is happy with the new DNA forensic laboratory.
This laboratory will play a very important role in our criminal justice system. Sexual and gender violence crimes such as rape and involvement will potentially be resolved using modern and validated scientific methods.
Speaking during the same occasion, U.S. Ambassador to Zambia, Michael Gonzalez, said the launch of the laboratory demonstrates the U.S. government's commitment to the fight against gender and sexual violence. The U.S. envoy said this is an important milestone in Zambia's efforts to hold perpetrators accountable under Zambian law. He also said preventing and responding to all forms of sexual and gender-based violence is a cornerstone of the U.S. government's commitment to promoting democracy, advancing human rights, and furthering gender equity and equality. He said the DNA forensics laboratory, staffed with highly trained technicians, has the ability to process tens of thousands of forensic submissions each year. Inspector General of Police Grafa Omusamba told the press there was a 63% increase in gender-based violence over the past year. The U.S. Embassy says in Zambia the number of cases more than doubled over the past 2 years. Nearly 9,000 cases were reported between July and September 2022, compared to only 4,000 over the same period of 2021. Perpetrators face up to 15 years in prison if found guilty in Zambian courts of law. And human rights groups hope DNA testing will ensure that they are brought to justice. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
At least 1.3 million people around the world are killed every year because of road accidents, with millions more sustaining injuries. The World Health Organization says traffic accidents are the leading cause of death among young people in Africa. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
As the UN, which is celebrating its seventh edition of Global Road Safety Week, reports that at least 150 people die every hour on the world's roads, young people under the age of 29 are the most affected. The UN resident coordinator in Tbilisi, Georgia Sabine Marshall, is calling for action to shift to more sustainable modes of transport and security.
We really need focus on improving the quality and the safety of the roads and all the vehicles. That we need to prevent drunk driving and speeding. Let us remember that every one of us, we have a role to play to making our roads safer.
Traffic accidents are the leading cause of death among African youth, and now the governments across the continent have come together to curb the rising causes of accidents. Gladys Somme lost her husband in a road accident in 2015 in Nairobi, Kenya.
I think this could have been avoided, and I wouldn't be husbandless. It's now about 7 years down the road, and it's still quite fresh in our memories. We want these accidents to be prevented.
According to a recent UN report, the main causes of road accidents include drunk driving, speeding, drowsiness, negligence, the failure of use of seatbelts and helmets, and non-compliance with traffic regulations. Husseina Islam says she was traumatized by the loss of her brother in an accident.
He died in a car crash. They rolled like thrice. The driver was like a drunkard and he was chewing and too much music. And my brother was like telling him there's a sharp road and you should be careful. And that's when the incident occurred.
The theme of the 7th UN Global Road Safety Week speaks specifically to the need for governments to encourage a shift to walking, cycling and using public transport. Alex Trozenberg is the World Bank Senior Managing Director, responsible for development policy and partnerships.
Did you know that road crashes kill 1,350,000 people annually and cost developed economies equivalent of 6% of their GDP on average? Improving road safety not only saves lives, it's also a powerful tool to unlock economic growth. That's one reason why road safety is a development priority for us.
The Global Plan for the Decade of Action for Road Safety 2021-2030 reflects an ambitious target to reduce road traffic deaths and injuries by 50% by 2030. The UN says road accidents can be prevented by addressing entire transport system, taking action to ensure safe roads, vehicles and behaviors, as well as improving emergency care. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
The National Union of Tunisian Journalists on Thursday protested to protect the freedom of the press after reporter Khalifa Ghousmi had his sentence increased to 5 years in an appeals court for counterterrorism. The union says this is the worst case so far of a growing crackdown of journalists in Tunisia. Reporter Elysia Fokman has more from Tunis.
Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press. And a free press, we won't settle for less. These are the slogans on placards written in Arabic, French and English for the world to read by members of the National Union of Tunisian Journalists, the SNJT. Freedom of speech and a free press were hard-won rights after the 2011 revolution. But today, journalists held a day of anger protesting against what they say is a growing crackdown on the media. This has been a very bad week for reporters in Tunisia, especially for Khalifa Ghousmi, who works for Tunisia's most popular private radio station, Mosaic FM. Ghousmi was originally tried and sentenced to 1 year in prison last November in a civil court because he refused to give the names and phone numbers of his sources to police. Ghousmi told Voice of America in a message that he couldn't speak about the case because, "I am still in shock about the unfair sentence of 5 years in prison." Lawyer Mohamed Ali Bouchiba, a member of Ghousmi's defense committee, explains what happened in the appeal court on Monday. The first trial took place in an ordinary civilian court of the first instance. There are four lawyers as part of Khalifa Ghousmi's defense committee in the appeal court for counterterrorism. We were shocked at the verdict because usually the appeal court's decision is more lenient. Never in the history of journalism Tunisia has such a severe sentence been handed down. There are many more cases against journalists now. I myself have five cases. There are other high-profile cases where journalists or media personalities are being investigated. Ghousmi is not the only Mosaic FM journalist to fall foul of the law this week. Dalila Ben Mabarek is the lawyer representing Elias Ghabi and Haitham El Mekki, co-presenters of the popular Midi show on Mosaic FM, a daily lunchtime political discussion show. She said in a statement that the presenters were under investigation for defamation and the propagation of rumours which affect internal security, for alleged remarks made on the show on Monday, May 15th. For the moment, Guesmi remains a free man, while his case is referred to the Court of Cassation, the highest court in the land, to decide on whether to uphold the appeal court's judgment or to refer his case for a further appeal court hearing. Guesmi says he will lie low as he fears arrest, and his lawyers are concerned because under President Kais Saied's constitution, the justice system is no longer an independent institution and is solely answerable to the president. Lawyers say that they now have a real fight on their hands. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Algeria, where the stage is now set for what promises to be a thrilling final between Senegal and Morocco at the Nelson Mandela Stadium in Algiers, Algeria, and the CAF Under 17 Africa Cup of Nations 2023. Senegal dominated Group A, defeating Congo 1-0, Algeria 3-0, and Somalia 3-0. The Lion Cubs of Taranga knocked out South Africa 5-0 in the quarterfinals before facing Burkina Faso, where a penalty shootout decided the match 5-4 in favor of the Senegalese. For their part, Morocco also had a similar path to the final. They finished top of their group ahead of Nigeria, who they beat 1-0, South Africa 2-0, and Zambia 2-1. In the quarterfinals, they eliminated host Algeria 3-0. In the semis, they needed penalties to advance 6-5 to the finals. So far, the CAF Under 17 Africa Cup of Nations Algeria 2023 has been a resounding success, attracting a number of top scouts from leading African clubs and also European clubs. And now to the CAF Champions League Africa Premier Club competition. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will chase a berth in the final of the CAF Champions League this weekend when they host Wydad Casablanca at the Loftus-Versfeld Stadium on Saturday for the second leg of their semi-final tie. The teams played to a goalless stalemate in the first leg at the Stade Mohammed V in Casablanca last Saturday night, though the result was very much an achievement for the South African side, given that they played more than half of the match with 10 men and ended with 9. Sundowns coach Rulani Mokwena is confident that his side can emerge victorious on home soil.
They play the type of football that Wydad play, that Al Ahly play, that Belouizdad play, which is predominantly wing play with very aggressive fullbacks who get into the final third and deliver crosses into the box. What you then have is a team that works very, very hard. That poses a different challenge to us than what we normally have.
In the first semi-final second leg tie to be played on Friday, Osporons de Tunis will have to overcome a 3-0 aggregate score line when they take on the experienced Al Ahly outfit in their CAF Champions League semi-final at the Cairo International Stadium. Al Ahly asserted their dominance against their North African neighbors last week Friday, putting 3 goals past the Tunisian outfit. In athletics, reigning world 10-kilometer record holder Kenyan Ronex Kipruto has maintained his innocence following his suspension for doping on Wednesday. In a statement released by his management agency, his agent Davor Savija denied allegations that the 23-year-old athlete breached anti-doping regulations. He accused the World Anti-Doping Body of mistreating athletes. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter, Turkey Votes. The nation's most fiercely contested presidential and parliamentary elections in a generation did not produce a winner on May 14, but incumbent president Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his AK Party defied the polls and outperformed the opposition. There will be lots of political jockeying in the run-up to a runoff election in 2 weeks. The significance of Turkish elections this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.